Now we are going to read a few poems.
Perhaps just before we move into the poems, I should say, I think it's always interesting to know how a poet regards, especially a contemporary poet, regards form. And to me, form is a sort of an essential part of poetry, and unless you give considerations to form, it seems to me you're not writing poetry. Again, to quote Robert Frost, I like what he said when he was asked once about why he was insistent on using form in poetry, and he said, because you don't play tennis without a net. And, or as he also said, half the fun is in how you say a thing. And I think it's that, both the challenge and the satisfactions of form, that appeal to me in writing. I know sometimes we act, sort of when we're acting as academics, we will go on and on about themes and motifs and that sort of thing. And but that always seems to me to be really quite a long way from the page where an actual poem appears, in much the same way as whatever our interests in literary theory. Theory is to poetry, it seems to me, as statistics are to an individual life. It's not saying that they're not valid, it's just that they're not necessarily that interesting. And I tend to use four stress lines, partly because if you use a five stress line in English, this is inviting unfortunate comparisons. And it also happens to be a form, when you're using four stress lines, to me anyway, it seems to me the form that most naturally fits in with conversational English. That if you're using three beats or even five beats, the reader can always sort of pick this up, and they know that you've entered into a kind of obvious and repetitive pattern. But with four stresses in English, I think it does give you more freedom. You're both involved in form and yet the freedom from that form at the same time. So I hope that doesn't sound sort of too trite to mention that, but it's interesting, I always think, to know what a poet thinks about what he's doing. And form, of course, is... Herman Melville, I think, said that form is the preserving salt. That it's all very well having something to say, but the way you say it has to try and be sort of memorable or in a form which gives some kind of interest or pleasure for its own sake. Which brings me finally to the point of which we often forget about with or don't insist on enough with poetry, and that is what philosophers have always known about art, of course, and have both liked it and disliked it for that reason, is the play element. That poetry doesn't have to do anything. Valerie has that marvellous, you know, that every student likes quoting it, that poetry is to prose, is dancing, is to walking. That we don't dance to get anywhere, we just dance for its own sake. And that's what poetry is after all, sort of the dance of language, the delight in patterns for its own sake. And, of course, like dancing, there may be ulterior motives as well. But primarily, I think form is both to try and give some memorable pattern to what you're saying, and also to give pleasure, that it gratifies that play instinct that we all carry with us sort of from childhood.
With a four stress line, you're closer to song with the rhythm of the ballad? Alternation of four stress and three stress line in the ballad?
Oh, yes. And in fact, of course, you can sort of approximate song and, yeah, and so on, and especially through just sort of a strict repetition with in any number of stresses. But for myself, the most important, not the most important, but an important thing as poetry, is to try not to get the language too far removed from the language we use every day, and yet at the same time to move it enough so it draws attention to that for its own sake. So that, in other words, it has one foot in the world of ordinary experience, ordinary language, but at the same time gives it the freedom, like the other leg of a compass, to move around doing other things and just having the solidity of where it begins, if that makes sense.
The music makes the difference between everyday life and...
Of course it does, yes.
Yeah. And how difficult it is to be at the same time an academic and a poet.
I think it's rather an unfortunate state to be. It's like asking Mr. Hyde what's it like to be a doctor. You know, there is something slightly unnatural about it, but then I think there's something slightly unnatural about work anyway, and we have to make a living. So it's not the best way for a writer to live, I think, because you're constantly aware of and confronted by, you know, much larger talents than your own. That's what you're teaching much of the time, and I'm not even touching yet on the temperament of colleagues who sometimes don't care for writers. No.
So shall we start with the reader on the beach?
This is probably if I might say so, and I hope it doesn't sound sort of too off-putting, a deliberately sort of intellectual poem, in the sense that it's relating very obviously to another poem that I've read. Most of my poetry doesn't have quite that literary sort of aspect to it, in inverted commas, that this one does. So I think what's going to happen, I'm going to read it in English, then Anne will read the translation for most of these. The Reader on the Beach. Our mentor, Monsieur Valéry, found it impossible, he says so, to take objects seriously qua objects. A dove will never be more than a dove, a bird given to awkward and repetitive occasions, until its foot prints cuneiform, we may later read the bird from in the reality of clay, which the dull bird renders interesting because of rain that morning, and the steaming acrid smell of cemetery mud, and the needles of the pines running quick points of wet fire. While the sea slopes off like a roof under which all possible words arrive, finned and predatory and placid. Can you imagine, however, Matra, such prints on the ocean's roof? Observe, he says, where the dove moves white as a sail pecking at the swell, though from here only its rare triangular wing. The book has been closed all morning, so too the eyes who read it, the watery sound of doves insistent somewhere. Eyes closed against the sunlight, pinkish sails full at last with everything not there.
Reading and translating this poem, I had an impression that you admired Paul Valéry, but at the same time you were very critical of his outlook.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm very admiring of it.
Yeah.
And I suppose I was just aware of the enormous distance between the way we usually think and someone that sort of can think both symbolically and yet with such complex dealing with the real, as Valéry does in that poem.
Le lecteur sur la plage. Notre mentor, Monsieur Valéry, trouvait impossible, c'est ce qu'il dit, de prendre au sérieux les objets, quoi objet. Une colombe ne sera jamais davantage qu'une colombe, oiseau s'adonnant à ses occupations de façon répétitive et sans à propos, jusqu'à ce qu'il imprime de la pâte une écriture cunéiforme qui nous le révèle ensuite dans la réalité de l'argile que le terne animal rend intéressante grâce à la pluie ce matin-là et la fumante odeur âcre de la boue du cimetière, les aiguilles des pins diffusant des pointes vives de feu humide, Tandis que la mer à l'oblique s'efface comme un toit sous lequel arrivent tous les mots possibles, avec ailerons, prédateurs et tranquilles. Imaginez-vous cependant, maître, ces empreintes sur le toit de l'océan. Observez, dit-il, où marche la colombe, blanche comme phoque picorant l'écume, bien qu'on ne voie ici que son aile rare, triangulaire. Le livre toute la matinée est demeuré fermé, de même que les yeux qui le lisent, les sons aquatiques des colombes sans cesse quelque part, les yeux clos dans la clarté solaire, des phoques rosâtres, pleins, enfin, de tout ce qui s'absente.
Now this next one is a much simpler, straightforward, sort of lyric, little sort of love poem, I suppose. Before you go, if you give me an apple, that would do. An apple you've picked yourself. Or one of those apricots that feels warm as a hand when you take it up from the table on the veranda. It says afternoon, any time of night or day. If you gave me one of those, I wouldn't mind, because it is February and a week of your walking around the house, your feet naked on the boards, seems a fair slice of life. An apple will do, or an apricot, before you go.
Avant que tu t'en ailles, si tu me donnes une pomme, cela ira. Une pomme que tu auras cueillie toi-même. Ou bien l'un de ces abricots, celui-ci, chaud comme la main quand tu le prends, sur la table de la véranda. Il dit « après-midi », à n'importe quelle heure de la nuit ou de la journée. Si tu me donnais l'un de ceux-là, ce ne serait pas de refus. Parce que nous sommes en février, et une semaine à te voir te promener autour de la maison, pieds nus sur les planches, voici à mon avis une belle part de vie. Une pomme, cela ira. Ou un abricot, avant que tu t'en ailles.
This next poem, which is called Talking of Stone, it doesn't really relate to this story that a Russian friend told me, but it came out of, I suppose, her family connection. She was a Jewish woman from Moscow whose uncle was executed. He was a journalist, and they were friends of Pasternak's, and she told me this story of how Pasternak received a phone call at 2 a.m, and the voice said, Comrade Stalin speaking, and so naturally he was a little apprehensive. And he said simply, do you think Mandelstam's a genius? An impossible question to ask a writer about another writer, of course. And he said, I don't know if he's a genius, but I think he's a very great writer. And Stalin said, if I was a writer, I'd defend my friends, and put the phone down. And of course, Mandelstam was taken off to the camps, and Pasternak then had to live with this, for a long time, which has always struck me as a very good illustration of the kind of experience writers in countries that aren't free as our countries are have to go through, that we have no conception at all of what it must be. We can read all the books we like, and the only way you get some indication of that kind of experience is in the poetry of the great the great Russians of last century. So this poem, of course, has nothing to do with that, but if you see how it sparked off this interest in trying to say something about Mandelstam, who, was a bizarre, extraordinary, courageous personality. The little phrase in it, Carmen, Carmen is the Russian for stone upon stone, from one of his poems. And this is the Notre Dame in Paris he's talking about, of course, in a poem when he refers to that. Mandelstam looked at Notre Dame, thought how heaviness was evil, how architecture's hoisting light from the back of shade was to come at beauty. Each breath raised the stone a fraction, each breath which is more, however little, than the man who breathes it, raises it, see, so horizons fatten between earth and sky. At the end of a lifetime's breathing, as a man ideally would like to breathe, on his own terms, to his own words, it is there, writing the skyline. It is there about him, that vault of such pure air, such redeemed stone. On the sky's edge, a cathedral so tall we absorb it, stone upon stone, carmen na carmen. Yet blood, as you always knew, putting it bluntly, slips its red flag from the lightness of earth's things.
En parlant de la pierre, Mandelstam, en regardant Notre-Dame, songea que le poids était le mal, que la lumière de l'architecture s'élevant du fond d'ombre devait atteindre la beauté. Chaque souffle éleva d'un peu la pierre, chaque souffle qui surpasse même menu l'homme qui le produit, l'élève. Voyez, de sorte que les horizons prennent corps entre terre et ciel. À la fin d'une existence à respirer comme un homme dont l'idéal aimerait respirer, selon lui, par ses propres mots, la voici, calligraphiant la ligne des toits, la voici près de lui, cette voûte de si pur respire, rédemption de pierre. À la lisière du ciel, cathédrale si haute que nous nous en imprégnions, pierre par pierre, kamen na kamen, le sang pourtant comme jamais vous ne l'avez ignoré, pour le dire sans embâge, dégage furtivement son drapeau rouge de la légèreté des choses de ce monde.
The next poem I'll read is called The Child in the Gardens, Winter. I suppose I wrote this because I'd been reading a book about Eden and the number of poems in which Eden is the place, of course, we always hate to leave, the enchanted garden of childhood. And this is sort of reversing that Eden notion and considering imagine there's the garden of childhood that we can't get out of soon enough, the sort of the negative side of Eden which poets are less likely to emphasize. How sudden this entering the fallen gardens for the first time, to feel the blisters of the world's father as his own hand does. It is everything dying at once, the slimed pond and the riffling of leaves, shoes drenched across sapless stalks. It is what you will read 1,000 times. You will come to think, who has not stood there holding that large hand, not said, can't we go back? I don't like this place. Your voice sounds like someone else's. You rub a sleeve against your cheek. You want him to laugh, to say, the early stars can't hurt us. They are further than trains we hear on the clearest of nights. We are in a story called Father, We Must Get Out. Leaves scritch at the red walls. A stone lady lies near the pond, eating dirty grass. It is too sudden, this walking into time for its first lesson, its brown wind, its scummed, nasty paths. You know how lovely yellow is your favourite colour, the kitchen at home. You touch the big gates as you leave, the trees stand on their bones, the shoulders on the vandaled statue are huge cold eggs. Nothing there wants to move. You touch the gates and tell them, we're not coming back to this place, are we, Dad?
L'enfant au jardin public, l'hiver. Comme soudain nous entrons au jardin public déchu pour la première fois pour sentir les ampoules du père du monde comme sa propre main les éprouve, c'est que tout meurt à la fois, l'étang couvert de vases et le frôlement des feuilles, les souliers trempés à fouler les tiges mortes. C'est ce que tu vas lire des milliers de fois, et tu en viendras à penser qui ne s'est pas trouvé là, tenant cette grande main, qui n'a pas dit « Ne pouvons-nous pas rentrer ?» Je n'aime pas cet endroit. Ta voix ressemble à celle d'un autre. Tu frottes ta joue contre ta manche, tu as envie qu'il rie, qu'il dise « Les premières étoiles ne peuvent nous faire du mal, elles, plus lointaines que les trains qu'on entend par les nuits les plus claires. » Nous voici dans le récit qui a pour titre « Papa, il nous faut partir ». Les feuilles frottent contre les murs rouges, une dame de pierre est couchée près de l'étang, mangeant de l'herbe sale. C'est trop soudain, cette intrusion dans le temps pour une première leçon, son vent bistre, ses méchantes allées crasseuses. Tu sais combien le jaune joli est ta couleur préférée, la cuisine à la maison. Tu passes la main sur les grandes grilles en partant, les arbres jugent sur leur squelette, les épaules de la statue vandalisée ont l'air d'immenses œufs froids. Rien là n'a le désir de remuer. Tu passes la main sur les grilles et leur dis « Nous n'allons pas revenir ici, hein, papa ?»
I'm always fascinated by how people erect systems of belief for themselves and then believe with such certainty that they can hardly conceive of someone not sharing that particular approach. And in fact, the madder such systems are, the more fascinating they seem to be. So the story of the monastic life, the man who created his particular framework out of his love for elephants, is crazy as it is. He's a man, sort of a figure that I really rather admire in this, and it's called the monastic life. A man visited the elephant house at the Auckland Zoo. He admired the animal almost beyond belief, beyond reason. He loved the indecision of the trunk, the shuffle from foot to hold the temple intact. He liked the tiny tail as though from somewhere else. He was not a rich man. He remortgaged to visit zoos in different countries. He needed, he said, to check elephant against elephant, to ensure the first that he saw was a fair and consistent instance. But if zoos were in collusion, true to type yet grossly furnished with defective exemplar, he went on safari. He witnessed elephant birth. He saw breath crush from the cathedral of an aged bull, brought down by ergot poisoning. But peace of mind was never on. The man could no more hold elephant as a verifiable concept than he could the living herd in the palm of his hand. His wife suggested horses as a more manageable obsession. But no, the man insisted, he had not come this far as devotee to waste time on fetlocks. Elephants, he said, at least have grandeur, massive greyness, unassailable grace. His definition came down to this: no elephant was required to meet human demand. We aspire, they are there. An elephant, au fond, is theology that sways.
I had to ponder a long time for the translation of the last line. Difficult to find the equivalent for that sway. Is it really what it meant? La vie monastique. Un homme visita la maison des éléphants au zoo d'Auckland. Il admira l'animal de façon quasiment déraisonnable. Il adora l'hésitation de la trompe, la pesante oscillation d'une patte sur l'autre, pour préserver le temple. Il aima la queue minuscule, comme si elle venait d'ailleurs. Ce n'était pas un homme riche. Il empruntait à chaque fois pour visiter les zoos dans différentes villes. Il lui fallait, disait-il, vérifier chaque éléphant l'un après l'autre pour s'assurer que le premier qu'il avait vu offrait un exemple cohérent et convenable. Mais si les zoos s'entendaient sur son dos, fidèles à l'espèce, mais largement dotés de spécimens défectueux. Il partit en safari. Il assista à la naissance de l'éléphant. Il vit le souffle abandonner la cathédrale d'un vieux mâle, terrassé par l'ergot de seigle, ce poison, mais n'obtint pas la tranquillité d'esprit. L'homme ne pouvait pas plus tenir éléphant comme concept vérifiable qu'il ne le pouvait dans la paume de sa main, le troupeau vivant. Sa femme lui suggéra les chevaux comme obsession plus maniable, mais non, l'homme affirma qu'il n'était pas allé aussi loin dans la dévotion pour perdre du temps sur le boulet du cheval. Les éléphants, déclara-t-il, possèdent au moins de la grandeur, une masse de gris, une grâce imprenable. Et voici, au bout du compte, sa définition. Aucun éléphant n'est contraint de satisfaire l'exigence humaine. Nous formons des vœux, ils sont là. L'éléphant, au fond, est théologie qui balance. I'm sorry, there is a big misprint in this line. Les éléphants possèdent ENT.
Right, now for the final grouping of poems, I'll start those with a poem called Still Waiting, Are We? Which I suppose in a sense is sort of is allegorical of the notion of aging and thinking that we're going to arrive at a point of truth. Which of course we never do, we simply get older. So still waiting, are we? It is so pointless, they will tell you, for hours at a time to watch the poplar lengthen across the lawn, so the cold inside the shadow and the warmth of the tree still blazed in 6 o'clock flare up, descant each to each. All right, you tell them. Admit that to look from the window at whatever is much as it always is, providing always as something else from time to time. But to look, yes, to the wasting away. Like knives at a distance, at a stone, its centre hollowed it so, so very much lisping, lapsing, whatever time does, however you say it, sharpening, wearing away. But the window, the quiet, so a boat ticks on the river half a mile downstream, a heifer's bellowing brash beauty, say, for all that. An answer, is that what you'd call it? Are you after that? Still at your window, they say, can't you give it a rest? Not on your life, tell them, not on your earthly.
This poem makes me think of Pan and Pans and Minuets with the will to feel time passing. Toujours l'attente, non? Cela ne rime vraiment à rien, vous dira-t-on, de regarder le peuplier des heures d'affilée s'étirer sur la pelouse, de sorte que le froid dans l'ombre et la chaleur de l'arbre encore vive dans l'embrasement de 6 heures, l'un l'autre se décantent. D'accord, répliquez-vous, vous admettez que de regarder par la fenêtre toute chose à peu près semblable à ce qu'elle est toujours, pourvu que ce toujours se modifie de temps à autre, mais regardez, oui, le déplacement vers l'ouest, le dépérissement, comme couteaux au lointain sur une pierre tant creusée au cœur, tant de langues trébuchant de choses caduques, quoi que fasse le temps, de quelque manière que vous le disiez, s'aiguise, s'use. Mais la fenêtre, le silence qui laisse entendre un bateau voguant au ralenti sur le fleuve à quelques centaines de mètres en aval, le meuglement d'une génisse à l'outrecuidante beauté, disons malgré tout une réponse. Est-ce là ce que vous diriez, ce que vous cherchez? Encore à ta fenêtre, dit-on. Pas possible de faire autre chose? Jamais de la vie, affirmez-le, jamais de la vie sur cette terre.
This next poem, which is called Late Romantic, I call it that because it's a poem about the moon, and it seems to me that by this stage we should have given up well and truly writing moon poems. It's, you know, the most overworked thing in any sort of romantic story or you know, Mills and Boone's story, the moon always has a big part to play. And so I realised that in writing about the moon, it was really trying to resurrect a very old and perhaps outmoded image. At least you think that until you look at the moon and you think, ah, and you're watching it for the first time. So it tries to get that notion as well. The moon mightn't be so fat if it wasn't for what we fed it. The parked car on the lip of the hillside, the river down there like a spoon raising light. The expanse of January paddock shaved as a monk, the expectations of Easter rising and rising, the Parthenon on a postcard like the skeletons of 10 dogs. It slips down the sides of houses easy as a brush. It pours so a lover on a veranda in horror Fenua breathes Christ, bathed solely in such election. First time we hold a child while its eyes glitter with its first puffed moon, we begin to tell it stories. Or someone says Aegean, and we fancy night varnished yellow. Yet raise your hand or both hands so the moon is covered, so the shape of your hands is edged in pale gloves. Darkness pours to fill its absence as though filling a bowl. Darkness thus becomes a moon we know by touch. Moon's braille seeps in at our fingers, our blood sparkles as its lake. Which is saying, once see it, you see it still. A million after a million after a million see it. Our adjectives maggot at moonlight till the old bone seethes.
Romantique tardif. La lune pourrait n'être pas si grasse si nous ne l'avions pas si bien nourrie. L'automobile garée sur la lèvre du coteau, le fleuve dans la vallée comme une cuillère soulevant la lumière, l'étendue des enclos de janvier en sa tonsure monacale, l'espérance pascale qui lève, le cesse, le Parthénon sur carte postale, tel le squelette de 10 chiens, glisse sur le flanc des maisons avec l'aisance d'une brosse. Se déverse de telle sorte qu'à l'amant sous la véranda à Orowina, il échappe, mon Dieu, baigné qu'il est en cette exclusive élection. La première fois que nous tenons un enfant dont luisent les yeux à voir sa première lune ballon, nous nous mettons à lui conter des histoires. Quelqu'un dit « Égéenne » et nous imaginons la nuit de jaune vernis. Pourtant, lever la main ou bien les deux jusqu'à en couvrir l'astre, de sorte que leur forme se nimbe de gants pâles, la ténèbre coule pour combler l'absence comme on emplit un bol. L'ombre se transforme ainsi en lune à connaître par le toucher. Et la lune en braille s'infiltre entre nos doigts, notre sang comme son lac brasillant. Ce qui veut dire, une fois vue, vue toujours, des millions de fois pour des millions de gens. Nos adjectifs, asticots à la lune, jusqu'à ce que frémisse le vieux squelette.
I should have mentioned earlier on, I noticed there's a couple of references in poems I've read to the fact that, of course, the seasons are occurring at different times over there. Otherwise, you might think that a poem about lovers being out in moonlight in a field in January might be a poem about masochists and so on, but it isn't. It's meant to refer to lovers. So now, this is called The Day My Father Died. Was just part of a long sequence.
No,
of
it's in the anthology.
It's in this one.
On page 206.
Okay, thank you. And it's quite self-explanatory, I think. I'm talking about a flame tree. What's a flame? Flame tree.
Flame tree.
You
have
arbre de feu. Yeah. Hmm. I don't know the botanical name for it, but it's a tree that in winter loses all its leaves in winter, and yet has brilliant scarlet hand-like flowers, sort of like that. On the day my father died, a flame tree with its stiff, immaculate flares cupped over the leafless branches outside the hospital window. Said for us several things voice could not get round to. Yet not only and not foremost, the riding of life above the stark branches, nor the perfect fan once the work is done, as though time shining is when the match is struck and is over, so. It spoke, each opening red fist only feet from dying, of small errors, of mornings forgotten by afternoon, of words taken or words put down lightly as a glass, or laid like a single log on a fire, or touched as the head of a child absently while other words moved on. The looks, brushings, immediate treasure, the cusps of morning lifting as sky lightens the withholding tree.
Le jour où mourut mon père, un arbre de feu aux raides flammes immaculées posées comme corolle sur les branches dénudées devant la fenêtre de l'hôpital, dit pour nous plusieurs choses dont la voix ne pouvait trouver le temps. Pas seulement toutefois, pas avant tout, la chevauchée de la vie sur les mornes branches, ni la perfection du mot « fin ». Une fois l'œuvre accomplie, comme si brillait le temps, une fois l'allumette craquée, puis consumée, de la sorte. L'arbre parla, chaque point rouge s'ouvrant à quelque distance de mourir, des petites erreurs, des matins que l'après-midi oublie, des mots saisis ou bien doucement posés, comme un verre ou placé sur le feu, comme une seule bûche, ou effleuré comme sans y songer la tête d'un enfant, tandis que viennent d'autres mots, l'allure, frôlement, trésor immédiat, les cornes lunaires au matin s'atténuant comme le ciel éclairci, l'arbre sur la réserve.
This is another elegy, again, which I think just sort of is perfectly self-contained. There's nothing to explain about it. It's called Elegy Again. You are on a railway platform in the driest country we had ever seen. We stand in the heat by a row of shagged pot plants, and think how green was always the colour as you came to mind. A green coat once by a corner in Florence when you didn't see me, leaning towards a match. You are 10 yards away and are the distance even then. Or our lying side by side, your hair that I joked was like a fire stalking a step behind you, a smoky brilliance even now, when words like desire are husks, shells, dead tongues, as once we reached them down from the living tree, the green sky, and our hands brushing like something scorched, loving without the palaver of having to say. And the utter ashes of it now, the same as if I had read about someone else, unmoved, and you, caged in freedoms, beyond flame.
Élégie à nouveau. Te voici sur un quai de gare, dans le pays le plus aride que nous ayons jamais vu. Nous voici debout dans la chaleur, près d'une rangée de plantes en pot, des broussailles, et je songe au vert, cette couleur qui toujours te fut associée, manteau vert jadis à l'angle d'une rue de Florence, cette fois où tu ne m'avais pas vu pencher sur la flamme d'une allumette. Tu te trouves à une dizaine de mètres, à la distance, même alors. Ou bien nous voici étendus l'un après l'autre, ta chevelure que je comparais en plaisantant à un embrasement, te poursuivant et cendrée, encore maintenant, alors que des mots comme « désir » ne sont que cosses, coquilles, langues mortes. Puisqu'un jour nous les avons décrochés de l'arbre de vie, le ciel vert et nos mains se frôlant comme brûlées, alors que nous nous aimions sans le souci du discours pour le dire. Et désormais, de tout cela, rien que cendre, comme si ce que j'avais lu en concernait un autre, me laissant de marbre, et toi, dans ta prison de liberté, transcendant la flamme.
And we'll finish with a more recent poem from my next my next volume. It's a poem called Not One to Let On, but I think, Anne, you're going to read this one first.
Motus, c'est bien elle. Il dit à l'enfant, écoute, quand tu dévoiles un secret, cela revient à te défaire d'un vêtement pour le tendre à quelqu'un d'autre. Et jamais tu ne le reverras. Vois-tu ce que je veux dire? Et si tu offres tous tes secrets, tu offres tout ce qui t'empêche de frissonner par les frimas, et il ne te reste rien à ôter quand il fait si chaud que tu te dis, je vais m'écrouler si je n'ôte pas un vêtement. Les secrets sont-ils donc si importants? Demanda l'enfant. L'homme lui répondit alors, tellement que je regrette presque de t'avoir dit cela. Et la fillette, qui avait 4 ou 5 ans, qui n'était ni plus intelligente que les autres enfants, ni en retard pour son âge, regarda droit devant elle, consciente qu'une chose importante se faisait jour pour la première fois. Une chose concernant les adultes, les mensonges, les secrets de sa mère, très différents de ceux de son père, car sa mère n'avait-elle pas affirmé, ne lui avait-elle pas dit, ne serait-ce qu'hier, qu'un secret était une vraie rareté qu'il te fallait porter, si tu en possédais suffisamment, si les autres gens t'en confiaient assez des leurs, tu ressemblais à la reine à la télévision, debout sur un mouvant monticule de fleurs, une baguette magique à la main, le soleil se montrant si elle avait envie de le faire paraître en son sourire. Voici l'importance que tu prends à l'instant où quelqu'un te confie ses secrets. Sa mère portait sa chemise de nuit quand, la serrant dans ses bras, elle lui fit cette révélation. Puis, il fut temps qu'elle aille chez son père et l'autre dame, même si cela est encore un secret.
Not one to let on. He told the child, listen, when you give a secret away, it's like taking off something you wear and handing it to someone else, and you're never going to get it back. You know what I mean? And if you give all your secrets, you've given everything that stops you shivering when it's cold, and nothing's left to take off when it's so hot you think I'll fall over if I don't take something off. Secrets are that important, the child said. And the man told her, so important I nearly wish I hadn't told you that. And the child, who was 4 or 5, neither clever among other children, nor slow for her age, looked straight ahead, knowing that something important was dawning for the first time. Something about grown-ups and lies and her mother's secrets, which were very different to her father's. Because hadn't her mother said, hadn't she told her only yesterday, that a secret was something extra special that you had to wear. If you had enough secrets, if other people gave you enough of theirs, you were like the queen on television who stood on a moving hill of flowers and carried a wand, and the sun came out if she felt like smiling it out. You were that important when someone tells you secrets. Her mother wearing her nightdress when she hugged her and told her that. And then it was time to go to her father's and the other ladies, although that is still a secret.